So, guessing like most of you, when you heard of the events in Parkland, Florida, that once again your heart was broken. You grieved with those that are hurting, and beyond that, you hope for something different. You hope that there's a day that we don't see that, and that changes would take place, and there would be real peace, and there would be real safety. And you know, one of the things I was thinking is, as the president spoke afterwards, he talked about getting together with the nation's governors, attorney generals, and that they were going to make our schools being safe a top priority. And I hope that happens. And I want to encourage you, whether you love our president, you hate the president, I don't know if anybody's neutral, but anywhere in there, I want to encourage you, we need to pray. We need to pray for the people that they would make good decisions. That they would gather people to the table and say, what isn't working? What can we do to make a difference? And I'm just going to say right now, I think if real conversations take place, that's going to be the miracle. Because here's something that I thought this week, and I struggle with this. Secondary to the loss of life, here's what really troubles me. We can't talk to one another. We're like people with bullhorns shouting past one another. I don't know where, real conversations take place anymore. And what happens pretty much every time something like this takes place, it's pretty predictable. I can go to my social media site, and what I'm going to see is a lot of straw man arguments, a lot of people talking about how stupid somebody else's answer to violence is. And I look at that and I think, well, some of these are clever, some of these have a hint of humor, but most of them are inappropriate and poor timing in the midst of people that are grieving and hurting. And I'm talking about the Christians. And I look at that and I think, if it's a contest to anger those outside the faith, we're doing a pretty good job. But if our hope is to point people to something different, to point people to hope in the gospel, gosh, I don't know. I don't know if that's what we're doing. And so what I want to do this morning, I want to point us to a better way. A better way that brings hope and that honors God. And for the Christian, our answer has to be the gospel. Now, I'm not talking about particulars. How do we deal with the school shootings, okay? So if you hear me coming up in your mind going, oh, he thinks this, and this is the way to go, that's not what I'm saying. You heard something I'm not saying. What I want to talk about is, how do we as Christians communicate to one another and to the world around us? And where's our heart? Because we can come to different conclusions, but what I want to know is, do we trace our conclusions back to the gospel? Or are the answers and the way that we communicate and the way that we share with people, can we go back to the gospel? Because if we don't start with the gospel, Here's the thing that we do. We forget who we are. We forget who God is, and we forget that God actually has a plan. And it's rooted and it's founded in the gospel. And we need to be reminded sometimes that the gospel is bigger. I mean, for years I was taught, hey, the gospel is someday you get to go to heaven. Well, the gospel is bigger than that. The gospel is the good news that Jesus Christ himself came. He came to rescue and restore and renew all creation. And through his death, burial, and resurrection, Jesus has defeated sin, he has defeated death, and he has begun a new work. And he started it within us. Jesus is transforming everything about us, about the community around us. And my invitation is to join him. We've got to start there. If we don't start there, all we're doing is making noise. And there's enough noise out there. We need to start somewhere else. And here's the reality. You can be agnostic, Buddhist, Hindu, whatever it is. Every person in this building, you have an overarching story of how you to live your life by. You know, your story could be nothing, right? There's nothing. Makes for a great Seinfeld, right? It's a story about nothing. That can be your story. But all of us have a story that we go to, we connect. It's how we understand. It's how we interpret the world around us. Now, some of us through life, we change stories. You know, how many of you think differently than you did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago? All right, these three people. And I would argue that the gospel is an invitation to exchange stories. For many of us, I mean, that's how I came to understand the gospel. As I was heading a certain way, I understood the world in a certain way. And then I heard the good news of the gospel. And I didn't say it in these words, but I looked back and I said, that's a better story. That's a better story than the story that I'm living. And I want to exchange that story. But here's what happens. Happens in my life, probably in two or three of you, is sometimes we forget part of the story. Or we compromise part of the story. And here's the thing. There's this built-in system. If you're not walking in the gospel, you're not following the gospel, there's this built-in system. It's called culture. And culture will form you and shape you, and you will become like the culture. I mean, that's just a reality. There's places where people are born, and because they're born in that society, they can pronounce certain words that the rest of us cannot pronounce. Okay? That's just science right there. And I look at that and I say, culture is very powerful. And so if we're not being shaped by the gospel, we're going to be shaped by something else. And a lot of times what happens, we compromise the story. And what we do is we're really kind of shaped by the culture. And there's a lot of things we like in the culture. And we say, well, let's just sprinkle some of the Christian principles on there that I like. And we call that Christianity. And we could go to God and God said, you know what, that's not really Christianity. And what happens when we do that is we lose credibility. Because people can look and they'll say, you're not faithful to the story that you say you follow. Now, let me give you an example from history, and I'll use a different culture because it's always easier to see it in someone else. So I'll do that, and then we'll go through Nehemiah. So there's a historian, John Duggal. And he tells a story that's about the hidden Christians of Japan. Anybody ever hear anything about the hidden Christians of Japan? All right. Just don't correct me until after the service, okay? So the hidden Christians of Japan, they literally had to hide within their own country. So starting from the 14th century to about the middle of the 1800s. And Duggal said that there was missionaries in the 1300s that went into Japan. And they started teaching people about Jesus. And people came to faith in Christ, but then it became illegal to be a Christian. And so they kicked out all the missionaries. And some of them stayed, but most of them got killed that stayed. And so for the next 500 years, these Japanese Christians would pass on this faith that they had. Now, fast forward 500 years, and Christians are allowed back into the country, and they met up with these hidden Christians, but the hidden Christians didn't want to worship with them. Well, here's what they found out. The hidden Christians' faith looked radically different than the faith that they received 500 years earlier. And in fact, the missionaries that came back in said that this looks more Buddhist than Christian. And so So over 500 years worth of time, the culture around them shaped them, and they had something that looked nothing like Christianity. Man, I'm glad that doesn't happen in America. And that's a reality, is you are going to be shaped by something. And what happened there is they forgot this story. They were living a different story. And you are going to be shaped by something. It could be the culture, or it could be the gospel. So we're going to look at Nehemiah. It was interesting because I was looking at Nehemiah this week in chapter 5. And I'm like, Lord, this is just such a depressing chapter. It's like it's one of those things where in Nehemiah's time, they're taking one step forward and they take two steps back. And but if you haven't been here the last few weeks, let me fast forward so you're right on target with everyone else. Nehemiah was this cupbearer for the Persian king, King Artaxerxes. Jewish people have been in exile for 70 years, and they're now returning. And Nehemiah finds out that Jerusalem is just in shambles and rubbles. The wall around Jerusalem has been burnt to the ground. Everything's a mess. Temple worship is just in disarray. And so Nehemiah asks for permission to rebuild the wall, secure the city, get temple worship started back up. And it's awesome. The first four chapters, we hear this story of these people that are coming back and they're facing incredible trials and hardships and opposition. But then they band together in the middle of all that and they start rebuilding the walls and temple worship is taking place. The restoration project is working. And then we get to Nehemiah chapter 5. Let's see what happens. Nehemiah chapter 5, and it's going to be on the screen behind you and on your phone. Nehemiah chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. And says, about this time, some of the men and their wives raised a cry of protest against their fellow Jews. They were saying, we have such large families. We need more food to survive. Others said, we have mortgaged our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get food during this famine. And others said, we've had to borrow money on our fields and our vineyards to pay our taxes. We belong to the same family as those who are wealthy, and our children are like theirs. Yet we must sell our children into slavery just to get enough money to live. We've already sold some of our daughters, and we are helpless to do anything about it, for our fields and our vineyards are already mortgaged to others. All right, let's get a clear picture here of what's going on. So they spent 70 years in exile. And you can look at, you know, Jeremiah and Isaiah. And there's two big things that go on that Jeremiah and Isaiah both preach about. They said, okay, the people are going into exile. And there was two big reasons. One, they forgot who God was. They forgot God. And secondly, the second big thing is they didn't care for the most vulnerable in their community. And God says, therefore, I'm allowing these nations to come in to conquer you. I'm sending you into exile for 70 years. So they come back in. And one of the first things they do is they sell their... people are having to sell their children into slavery. Now just ponder that. The temple worship's up. It's going... they're singing the right songs. They got the right liturgy. They're saying the right words. Their theology is solid. But they're selling their children into slavery. And here's the thing. Restoration without transformation is not restoration. It's religious activity at its worst. We need something to change. Now here's something we should know. Nobody's doing anything illegal. Technically. What's going on is the standard practices in that region of the world. This is how business operated. Now here's the problem with that though, is the standard operating business procedures are causing people to be sold into slavery. There's a second problem. The second problem is God took Israel, and he said to Israel, I will be your God, you will be my people. You will be the one nation that the rest of the nations of the world can look to and say, that's what it means to be my people. You are the people that they can look to and they say, that's what it means to be in a relationship with God. And so you look at what's going on here in the book of Nehemiah. Were they doing anything wrong? According to the culture, no. According to God, yeah. It's huge. And here's the thing. Israel forgot who they were. They forgot their purpose, who they were supposed to be in the world. They were shaped by the culture. In the book of Acts, we're told that Christians were first called Christians in Antioch. And they weren't called Christians because they could fire off the best one-liners or knock down the straw men of the people around them. That's not why. They weren't even called Christians based on, man, that guy must be a Christian. He really knows his Bible. That's not why they were called Christians. Christian at that time was actually a derogatory term. They didn't call themselves Christians. Those on the outside called them Christians. Christian means little Christ. In other words, the people around them looked at them, and the worst thing that they can come up with is, you guys look just like Christ. How awesome would that be? How awesome would that be? They say, oh man, these people that go to Hope Community Church, they're so much like Christ. They're just weird. They practice this holiness thing. They live lives that are right with God. They're grace-filled. They don't just talk about reconciliation, but they go out and seek to be reconciled with others. There's a healing presence with them. They live sacrificially. They bring hope. They love their enemies. These people are weirdos. I mean, that'd be great if that was like the best accusations that people can come to us with. Well, let's look at Nehemiah's response. He's got all this mess going on. And Nehemiah responds. Verse 6, it says, then I heard their complaints, and I was very angry. Verse 7. And after thinking it over, what a radical idea. He doesn't just fly off the handle, doesn't fire off a tweet or a Facebook post or a whatever, I don't even know what else is out there. But he says, after thinking, in other words, he paused and thought, okay, we represent God. What should we do here? And he says, and I spoke out against the nobles and the officials, and I told them, you're hurting your own relatives by charging interest when they borrow money. And then I called a public meeting to deal with the problem. And at the meeting, I said to them, we're doing all that we can to redeem our Jewish relatives who had to sell themselves to pagan foreigners. But you're selling them back into slavery again. How often must we redeem them? And they had nothing to say in their defense. And then I pressed further. What you're doing is not right. Should you not walk in the fear of God in order to avoid being mocked by enemy nations? That last verse there, verse 9, I think that's kind of the key that ties it all together. Because what Nehemiah is saying is that the nation of Israel and God himself is being mocked because of how we live. And here's something you can bank on. Just take this check to the bank and cash it. When you and I, when we forget part of our story, our enemies, those who don't believe the gospel, they know that part of the story. Okay? They may not know anything else about what Jesus said. But the part that you and I forget, they're going to know that part. All right? That's just the reality. And the nations around, they knew that. They knew that Israel, they said, okay, these people here, they believe that they worship the one true God who is holy and righteous. They believe that they worship this God that created the heavens and the earth. And they believe that people are created in the image and likeness of God. And those people are forcing their own relatives to sell people created in the image and likeness of God into slavery. What a farce. What a joke. And I could see it. If that's what it means to follow God, no thanks. We've got our own messed up methods. I think that's why in Romans 2:24, the Bible tells us this. No wonder the scripture says, the Gentiles blaspheme the name of God because of you. And that's a reality. When I do not walk in the integrity of the gospel that I claim to follow, I lose credibility. And God is mocked. I'm not saying that they're right, but that's a reality. God is mocked when I do not walk in the integrity of the gospel. Does that mean I have to do that perfectly? No. There's this thing called forgiveness and repentance and reconciliation and saying, hey, I messed up. When I said that, I was not walking in the integrity of the gospel. And by the way, that's walking in the integrity of the gospel when you admit that you were not. See, the New Testament tells us to live lives that are beyond reproach. What does that look like? That means that somebody could look into our life and they could look at how we live and say, you know what, there's an extraordinary consistency in what that person says, what they claim to believe, and what they're actually about. And that's when you and I earn credibility with those around us. And here's what happens. Lots of times people will look and say, I may not believe what they believe, but there's no doubt in my mind that that person believes what he says he believes. And I think that gives us a voice at the table. That gives us credibility. And we don't earn that by mocking the culture or by mimicking the culture around us. A few years ago, I had a conversation with somebody. And it was one of those things where I put off the conversation. But this person was on a crusade to fight everybody and everyone that appeared to be against the things that they were against. And so I said, hey, we need to talk. And I said, I know you think you're doing the right thing, but you're not winning people to Christ. You are repelling people away from Christ by the words that you speak. And I'm not even saying you're wrong in what you believe. But your attitude behind it repels people away. And this person repented and got right with God. No, this person said, I don't care. I am tired of Christians being pushed around and having no one to stand up and say anything. And you know what? I get that. I mean, I who here likes to be pushed around? Besides Tyler. Yeah, no one. I mean, seriously, what does Jesus expect us to do? Turn the other cheek? Love our enemies? Crazy talk like that? Oh, actually, he does do that. I'm not that sarcastic when I talk to people. But I said, you know what? I get what you're saying. There are things going on in our nation. There are things that people are saying. I don't like it either. But here's what you're saying. You're saying, I don't like that non-Christians act like non-Christians. So I'm going to respond in an un-Christ-like manner. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Because either I believe this is true or I think my ways are better. Now, we didn't get real far. And here's what happens. I'm guilty of this myself. Sometimes I choose my rights. Because you know, I'm the offended party here. They're talking against me. But sometimes I choose my rights and my thoughts over what God says. And here's the odd thing about it. We typically feel righteous in that. I'm defending God in a way that he said, don't defend me. Man, I've been struggling this week, and I just kept praying, Christ, I want to be like you, Christ. I want to be like Jesus. Because there's times in my own life, I don't want to respond like Jesus. But he's the one that I want to be conformed to. And when we're conformed to him, we can honor God and we have credibility. People might not agree with us. Well, let's see what Nehemiah does. Because Nehemiah had credibility. Verse 10. He says, I myself, as well as my brothers and my workers, have been lending the people money and grain. But now let us stop this business of charging interest. Skip down to verse 14. It says, the entire 12 years that I was governor of Judah, from the 12th year to the 32nd year of the reign of King Artaxerxes, neither I nor my officials drew on our official food allowance. In other words, he did his job for free. The former governors, in contrast, they laid heavy burdens on the people, demanding a daily ration of food and wine, besides 40 pieces of silver, and even their assistants took advantage of the people. Because I feared God, I did not act that way. I also devoted myself to working on the wall and refused to acquire any land. And I required all my servants to spend time working on the wall. I asked for nothing, even though I regularly fed 150 Jewish officials at my table, besides all the visitors from other lands. The provisions I paid for each day included one ox, six choice sheep, or goats, and a large number of poultry. And even in every 10 days, we needed a large supply of all kinds of wine. Yet I refused to claim the governor's food allowance because the people already carried a heavy burden. Remember, oh my God, what I have done for these people and bless me for it. There's a guy that has credibility. There's a guy you could say, okay, he believes what he's saying to this people. Was it easy? Probably not. Now think this through. Nehemiah sacrificed what was rightfully his. He could have demanded all of those things, and you could look and you'd say, there's nothing wrong with that. But he had a higher principle. There's a higher principle. You probably saw this guy in the news. Aaron Faze. This man was a coach. He was a Christian. He lost his life in the shooting. He lost his life because he shielded children with his own body. Shots were being fired. He got in the way and got in between the gunman and the shooter. Why would Nehemiah sacrifice? Why would Nehemiah give up what was rightfully his? Why would this young man step in front of bullets? Here's why. They believed in a better story. They knew that there was something better. How do we honor God and have credibility with people? Well, the New Testament puts it this way. This would be a great way to live, by the way. Romans 12:12 says this. It says, be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. And I think he needs to repeat it because maybe somebody didn't hear it the first time. He says, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. He says, live in harmony with one another. Don't be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Don't be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful what you do, what is right in the eyes of everyone. He says, if possible, as far as it depends upon you, live at peace with everyone. He says, don't take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath, for it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. In other words, God says, I could take care of myself. Verse 20, he says, on the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. If you do this, you'll be heaping coals on his head. And by the way, that's just a picture of shame. He says, do not overcome evil. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I think that's a starting place. I think that's a starting place that gives us position at the table. I think that's a starting place of where our hearts need to start and how we communicate with others. Now here's a question. Let's say we're really radical and we're just going to say, well, this is what God says to do, so I'm just going to do this. Is your life going to get easier? Most likely not. You know, and if I was looking for something easier, I would go get a real job rather than church plant. That's just a reality. Following God is not easier. But here's the thing. It's a way forward. It's a way forward that gives hope. And people around us, they need hope. People around us need a better story. And here's the thing. All of us here, you are invited to a better story. You are invited to live that better story. And you're invited to share this better story with others and invite them to join with you. I'm going to have the worship team come up. And if God's working something in your life where you're going, yeah, you know what? I'm doing something that's kind of Christian, but it looks a lot more like the culture with some Christian principles sprinkled on, and I want to be more like Jesus, and so Lord, have your way with me, conform me to your image, and I'll tell you, it's going to honor God, and at a minimum, people are going to look and say, I may not agree, but those people have something that I want. They have a hope that I don't understand.